In this episode, the great Dr. Style speaks about a wide range of topics, from sequencing the body, the interrelation of structure and function, what it means to find health, and how to define somatic dysfunction. He also speaks about OMT as an optimal tool to help people find health, prevent disease, and the importance of coming up with a hypothetical process for the somatic dysfunction. Enjoy this conversation on a wide range of topics related to osteopathy. This is episode 100 of the Osteopathic Manipulative Medicine Podcast, where we share clinical stories and pearls related to osteopathic medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ben Green, a third-year osteopathic neuromusculoskeletal medicine resident at Michigan State University.
And I am your co-host, Dr. Jordan Little, an intern at the same program.
We are bringing back a special guest who has the most listened to episode on this podcast, episode 61, titled A Career of Learning from the Pillars in Osteopathy. It's only fitting to bring him back for episode 100 to share more of his clinical wisdom. This guest is the wise age of 86 years old. He shows no signs of slowing to both teach and share his love for osteopathy. He has worked with and learned from many of the greats in the field of osteopathic manipulative medicine, including George Andrew Laughlin, grandson of A.T. Still, and Fred Mitchell Sr. A pioneer for the profession, he established the first hospital-based OMT service in the country in 1973 and developed the first five-level OMT coding system. In 1975, he was named a fellow of the American Academy of Osteopathy. He has been the mentor for hundreds and more likely thousands of osteopathic physicians and medical students. We welcome to the podcast the man, the legend, one whom we owe much gratitude for the work he has done for the field of osteopathic manipulative medicine, Dr. Ed Stiles, D.O.
Hello.
Dr. Stiles, thank you for coming back on episode 100 of the podcast.
Well, my pleasure.
It's a great honor to have you, and we're excited to listen to what you have to say. I talked to you earlier and we talked about two topics for this evening's conversation. One being the philosophy of osteopathy and how the philosophy may be applied to modern Western medicine. And the second topic being sequencing and how you discovered sequencing and how you've used and continue to use sequencing in your practice. But before we get into those topics, I think Dr. Little may have a few introductory questions for you.
Yes. I am very curious, Dr. Stiles. What is something that you have read for leisure or just to stimulate your mind in some way, shape, or form recently?
You know, it's interesting because I'm still doing a lot of teaching, and I've been doing more podcasts. And like, I was up at the Ohio School teaching all weekend, a couple weekends ago and stuff. And I'm still spending an awful lot of time generating new lecture material and everything. And I don't sit, because if I sit down and like watch a documentary or a movie or stuff, about halfway through it, I think about a slide I want to make. And I'm out of there. But no, a lot of the stuff I like to read now is the complex science stuff, because it has the language and the terminology we need to bring osteopathic thinking into the 21st century.
So you stick to pretty scientific literature?
Yeah.
If you could bring one article to mind, is there one that you would recommend?
Well, I'd recommend several, and I would Google the name Donald Ingber, I-N-G-B-E-R. And he's a very interesting guy. He's an MD, PhD at Harvard, who is a pathologist by training, but is a clinical researcher, and has developed a lot of the research on tensegrity and how it applies to clinical medicine. And this stuff is profound in what he's saying. And he's had some interesting TED presentations and things, but I'm convinced that in 50 years, when they talk about the big names in manual medicine, they're going to talk about Andrew Taylor Still, William Sutherland, and I think they'll say Donald Ingber, because he's really giving us the language and the concepts to explain a lot of what Still wrote.
Yeah, very cool. On the note of tensegrity, I just want to see if you've heard of this guy, the Strand Beast. Like, it's a tensegrity, kind of almost like an artwork. But the Strand Beast wind-powered sculptures.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Oh, my goodness. I watched some of those videos on YouTube the other day. It's just mind-blowing how he can make something move so fluidly with just the wind.
See, and what Ingber is saying, he had a big article in Scientific American in 1998. And what he basically said is there's a big needle sculpture on the mall in Washington. And it's a bunch of rods that don't touch or connect, but they're all interconnected by a continuous wiring system. And it's very tall. It's very flexible. It's very strong. It has all sorts of amazing characteristics. And Ingber is saying that the 206 bones of the body represent the rods, and the wires represent the myofascial tissues of the body, and that our musculoskeletal system is a tensegrity system.
Yeah,
that's great. I think there was an article that... Go ahead, Dr. Stiles.
No, and why that's important is because it can... He gives us the language of Still's thing on structure and function are related. Because he's done studies showing that he can put tension into tissues, and it can change the biochemical and genetic and physiological expression of those tissues. So there's what Still was talking about, structure and function be interrelated. I mean, it's phenomenal, the stuff that he's writing and publishing and has published.
Yeah, that's great. And I think there was an article that came out, I think it was actually in the New York Times in the last month, which talked about this new tissue called fascia and how it had nerve innervations and proprioception and mechanoreceptors. And so I think you're right. I think the scientific community is catching on to the importance of the fascial tissue in the body.
But it's a lot more the PhDs and MDs in Europe that are getting into it. And I've been to several of the international fascia conferences. And it's interesting because you hear these big name foreigners stand up and say, A.T. Still had it all right about fascia, that our research is supporting everything that he said.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I know they do a lot of, I think as far as I know, the leading institution in fascial research is the laboratory of Carlo Stecco and the University of Padua in Italy.
Yeah. Yep. They're big names in it. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. In Ingberg, I'll have to look up some of his writings then and articles.
Yep.
Go ahead, Jordan.
Just another kind of get to know you question. Are you a music person, Dr. Stiles?
Yes. Yep.
What kind of music do you like to listen to?
Jazz.
Oh. A
lot of the old jazz, and a lot of my favorite stuff is the Preservation Hall stuff out of New Orleans.
Okay. Do you play any instruments?
Yep. I used to. I don't as much anymore. Once in a while I do, but for years I played the marimba and vibraphone.
Okay. Have you played with a group, or is it just kind of been an independent?
No, it was more of going all through college and stuff. I had a small dance band. Okay. We used to play at college stuff and everything, but and we had my marimba piano player, a bass player, and a drummer. And we just played a lot of the school functions and everything. And we did that all the time that I was in Kirksville. I mean, in undergrad school at Bates College up in Maine. And then I played a little bit when I was in med school, but not much. And I play it every once in a while.
Do you also dance with playing music?
I used to do a lot of dancing. I don't anymore because I've had a bunch of old ankle and knee injuries from skiing and soccer and stuff. And my legs aren't the most flexible as they used to be. So,
yeah, that's been a hobby or a pastime that I've been trying to get more into is finding some swing dancing clubs and all that good stuff.
Yep.
Jordan is the musician in our residency.
Dr. is that right? What do you play?
I play piano. I was born and raised on my piano. And recently, I've been trying to pick up my ukulele and learn more of a 4 to 6 stringed instruments.
Oh, wow.
My brain is having a tough time translating the piano to a guitar and ukulele. But
yeah, I always wanted to learn banjo.
You're in the land of Kentucky. I feel like that's the place to play the banjo.
I just came here in 97, so this, because I grew up in Connecticut and then spent all my youth in Connecticut, then went to Maine to go to college, and that's when I fell in love with the state of Maine. And then 4 years in Kirksville, and then I spent about 12 or 13 years in Maine. And then 20 years in Oklahoma, and now 25 years or 27 years in Kentucky.
Yeah, Dr. Stiles, let's get into your career experience. You know, we talked a little bit about your life and how you fell in love with osteopathy and your work with Laughlin and Fred Sr. in episode 61. Today, we kind of wanted to talk about two specific topics. The first being osteopathic philosophy and how we may implement that in modern Western day medicine. So if you want to talk about that, be great.
Yeah. So I'd encourage you to look up a couple of words. Historically, going way back to Hippocrates, there have been basically two schools of medicine. One is the Asclepian school. It's Asclepian. And then the other is Hygienian, Hygieian. And the Asclepian is more a disease focus. So that's the background for the traditional allopathic medicine we see today. The hygienian is more host orientated, and that would correlate more with Oriental medicine. There was, at one time there were over 80 homeopathic medical schools in the country, and they were basically host orientated and stuff. And I think osteopathy should come out of the host-orientated model more than the disease model. But why not put those two together and work both sides of the street? And then I think we could really do what Still wanted to do, was to expand the practice of medicine. He didn't want to replace it or anything. He just wanted to explain it. And I think then that host model, hygiene and the sleeping, you put those together, then you can really integrate osteopathic thinking in traditional allopathic thinking.
And why is this topic kind of near and dear to you? Is there something that you're seeing in osteopathic medicine?
Well, I was first introduced to those concepts by our physiologist at Kirksville, a guy named Irving Kaur, that was an amazing guy. And he was way ahead of his time. But he talked about this stuff. But where it really came into play for me was when I started teaching in the postgraduate stuff at Michigan State, and MDs were coming through, and dentists and PTs they didn't want to hear the osteopathic lingo and that we were treating disease with manipulation. But if I explained the sleeping and the hygiene and said, I'm approaching the patient from the host side, but because I have a DO background and when I was doing general practice, then I applied appropriate allopathic care along with it. But this way you could put it together, and more MDs said to me, that makes sense, that you're helping the host realize its health potential. And if you do, then probably they're going to get healthier and the disease process they have may get better and it may reverse and may change.
So I'm looking up, I just Googled the I can't even say the word.
Asclepian, yeah.
Asclepian and Hygieian, and like the two Greek, so the Greek god of, says Greek god of health and the Greek god of healing.
Yeah.
So with that note and that quote from Still, the object of the physician is to find health.
Yep.
Find disease. What would you say that means, to find health?
Yeah. So when I walk into the room with a patient, I like to look at it as, when doing the hospital program at Waterville, I found an epidemiology article one day, and it was saying that there was an epidemiology triad, and it was host disease and I forget what the third thing was now, or environment. And I was thinking, boy, that's pretty neat. And what I found was that I think if Still was alive today, I think what he would say is that something had to lower the patient's resistance and increase their susceptibility to viruses and bacteria and whatever. And that somatic function could do that. And the way it could do it is it could have a profound effect on circulation through the sympathetic motor and vasomotor changes. It could affect sympathetic motor innervation to viscera. It could affect the parasympathetic innervation. It could affect, can you still hear me?
Yeah. We still hear
okay.
You.
No, I had a call come in. And it could affect the parasympathetic innervation. Then if the rib cage mechanically isn't working right, they can't ventilate properly, so they can't oxygenate tissues well. And that the rib cage mechanics is the pump for ventilation, venous and lymphatic circulation. So that somatic dysfunction could affect any one of those arms, basically, of the tissue or factors in the tissue. And it could be one, it could be all, it could be any combination. See, and then the etiology becomes very complex. And so then I see my job is to find the hindrances to their homeostatic potential. And sometimes that's going to be lifestyle changes. Sometimes it's going to be manipulation. Sometimes it's going to be psychology or psychiatry. Sometimes it's going to be lifestyle changes. It could be a lot of things, but removing the hindrances. And then I think what you're doing is enabling that patient to emerge into a more healthy potential. And I think that's what Still was said. I think he would say today, find the hindrances, fix the hindrances, and leave it alone and let the body, let health emerge out of that.
I see.
I did a lot of research with some PhDs and PTs up in Oregon. And what we found is these people were on a sophisticated treadmill for several minutes running. And then I would take them into a room and sequence them out and treat them. Then we'd put them back on the treadmill. And 80% of the people, the first time I treated them, we saw dramatic changes in all sorts of function within the body. And what was interesting, it was everything tend to trend back towards health. So if muscles were too tight, they automatically relaxed. If muscles were hypotonic, they toned up. And I didn't have to think about stretching out muscles or exercising muscles or toning muscles or whatever. If you get the somatic dysfunction out, the body tends to go back towards a healthy pattern. And I think I teared up when I first saw that data over and over in patients, because I thought, Still had it right. Find it, fix it, and leave it alone.
How would you define, Dr. Stiles, somatic dysfunction? You know, because how would you explain that to an MD physician? Let me ask you that.
It's mechanical dysfunction. Because see, for a long time, we talked about the osteopathic lesion. See, and when we started teaching at Michigan State, the MD said, you can't use that term. I said, what do you mean we can't use that term? They said, a lesion, you can biopsy it, and you can look at the tissues under a microscope. With what you're describing, you can't do that. So that's when we started talking more and more about restrictive barriers and that they, the joint was not a place. It was just restricted within its normal range of motion. But once that joint became dysfunctional, then depending on where it was in the body, it could affect any of those mechanisms that I just recently mentioned, those six or seven different mechanisms of circulation, innervation, trophic flow, ventilation, venous and lymphatic circulation and stuff.
Are you of the belief that, you know, each joint has mechanoreceptors, proprioceptors that's constantly feeding information back to the central nervous system?
Oh yeah.
The central nervous system is sending the efferent signal back to the myofascial system to stabilize the joint.
Yeah, but see, for several years, about the last 10 years in Oklahoma, the head of the physiology department at the University of Oklahoma kept inviting me to come up and talk to the physiology department about osteopathy. And he was, Bob Foreman was the guy's name. And at that time, he was considered one of the top leading of 10 leading authorities in the world on visceral somatic reflexes. And so one time I was up there, and went up to talk to him, and they said, "Oh, we're glad you're here, because Joe over here, he's got tennis elbow, and he's had it injected three times, and they tell him it hasn't gotten any better. In fact, it's worse. And they tell him they can't inject it anymore with steroids, and he's desperate. And how would you look at it osteopathically?" So I checked it, and he wouldn't pronate at all. And they had a hard infield, and the other side would pronate, and it was a spring, and I thought, ooh. So I said, "Okay, all of you physiologists, come up and feel this." And they said, "Oh, yeah, we can see that that right hand doesn't get parallel with the table. The left one does. And it only gets about 45 degrees from it. And it has a hard infield." Yeah. And I thought, ooh, I just got a bunch of physiologists to palpate somatic dysfunction. Then I thought, I hope that thing changes. And I set it up to do a muscle energy technique. And fortunately, the first muscle effort, that thing popped louder than anything I ever heard pop. And he had full range of motion. And I said, "Okay, come back up and feel this now." And they all said, "Wow, range of motion is normal on both sides now. That hard infield is gone. Whoa, how do you explain that?" And Bob Foreman said to me, "How would you explain that?" And I said, "Well, I think what's going on is you had mechanical dysfunction in that radial head. So there was a pain spasm cycle going on. And once I reestablished normal mechanics, I broke that cycle." And Bob Foreman said to me, "You're absolutely right, but you missed a big piece of the problem." And I said, "Okay, what do you mean?" And he said, "We've taken dogs and stimulated a spindle in the paw of a dog. And you're absolutely right. It will set up a cord reflex, pain spasm, pain spasm, pain spasm." But he said, "The firing is minuscule compared to the firing it produces in the cerebellum and in the sensory cortex." And I thought, oh my God. See, I think somatic dysfunction may be more of a software problem than a hardware problem. And we're picking up the hardware problem, but I think a lot of that stuff is stored in the cerebellum.
Interesting. So,
and that when we treat it, we break that cycle too.
So would you define then somatic dysfunction as a mechanical dysfunction with restrictive barriers that may be found within the joint, but also within the central nervous system?
Yeah, and secondarily that, because Core's research at Kirksville when I was there, he found that somatic dysfunction would produce what he called facilitation. And now they call it stimulation or sensitization, they call it, because they never gave, the MDs never gave Core credit for discovering this. But what he found was it could either stimulate or inhibit the innervation associated, and you couldn't predict whether that mechanical dysfunction was going to either stimulate or inhibit it.
Interesting. Okay. So how does this relate, what we're talking about, somatic dysfunction, defining somatic dysfunction, how does that relate to the osteopathic philosophy and how that applies to Western medicine?
Well, something had to predispose the system to be hindered for a disease process to develop, because health is a lot more prominent in most people, you know. So something had to lower their resistance and increase their susceptibility. So what I say to the patient is, okay, you've got pneumonia. Now, if you have pneumonia, secondarily, you can have a lot of rib cage dysfunction that can impair your ability to ventilate. It could affect venous lymphatic drainage out of those tissues. It could affect the sympathetic vasomotor supply, so that you may have a good blood level of medication, but you may not be getting a good tissue level. So the medication may be whizzing around in the body, but not getting to where it's supposed to be going to that disease process. And so in that way, I'm going to examine you, in addition to, say, writing a script for you, I'm going to examine you, see if I find mechanical dysfunction that could correlate with your clinical picture. And if we do, then that may help me be able to explain why you have this now and develop a patient-specific pathophysiological hypothesis of what's going on in you.
So essentially what you're saying is, let me see if I'm understanding what you're saying, because it kind of led me to a question that, well, let me just ask the question. Do you think that somatic dysfunction predisposes an individual to a disease process?
Yes. Yep.
Would you say that, let's talk about a patient with pneumonia.
Yep.
Do you think if you optimize diaphragmatic movement, they have limited myofascial restriction in the thoracic inlet and outlet?
Yep.
And good rib cage mobility, that patient, the host, is less likely to have pneumonia.
Yeah, or if they have it, that it'll heal up quicker.
Okay.
Now, but I have problem with just people like focusing on diaphragmatic techniques, because and this all goes back to Mitchell Sr., because there's always been a big argument, you know, doing diaphragmatic techniques and thoracic and ribcage techniques. So what Mitchell Sr. did is he had the doctor, where the tutorial was being held, have us each put on a rib binder real tight around our rib cage, and then go outside and walk quickly. And in no time flat, we were short of breath. Now, there was nothing wrong with our lungs. There was nothing wrong with our bronchial tree. There was nothing wrong with our diaphragm. But because that rib cage was so locked up, we were short of breath. And as soon as you took that binder off, whew, it was totally different. See, so I think I've seen people who have had diaphragmatic techniques done and it temporarily helped them. But if you got the rib cage mechanically working right, then the diaphragm automatically functioned well.
Mm-hmm. We should do that with the med students. We should put them in straight jackets and have them try to breathe. What it's like, and then take it off and say, hey, you know, this is your rib cage not moving well. This is your rib cage moving well.
Yeah.
Jordan, did you have any questions for Dr. Stiles?
Yeah, it's still forming. So we'll see how it comes out. but with allopathic, osteopathic, or however you want to categorize these two different philosophies, whether it's through the Greek kind of perspective with the Hygieian and I still can't say that word.
Asclepian.
Whether it's through that lens, what would you identify as like driving factors for why they are different?
Pushing them up. Yeah, I think some people, you could have 100 patients with pneumonia, and I think easily you could have, say, 50% of them purely asclepian, and man, they're going to respond beautifully to medical care. But then there are going to be some that there's going to be a host component, and they've had all the medical care and pulmonology people looking at them, and they're just not getting any better. And I've seen this in consultations in the hospital many times, whereas then I'd find somatic dysfunction was affecting the rib cage, the thoracic area, the cranium, because that can affect cranial sacral movement and everything, and it can affect the vagus and bronchial constriction. and have the patient see an immediate dramatic change right after you treated them. Well, then that patient needed both host care and disease care. Then I think there's some people, they've been on, like I've been treating a kid right now that has chronic ear infections, and they wanted to put tubes in, and the mother's an RN and didn't want the kid to have tubes. So the ENT doc referred the patient to me. The kid's like now a little over 2 years old. And so the first year of its life, it had constant bilateral ear infections on all sorts of antibiotics, and they weren't responding at all. Or they'd respond a little bit, but then in a couple of weeks, the kid would have an ear infection. So they referred him to me. I found all sorts of cranial dysfunction around both temporal bones. See, and if the temporals aren't moving well in cranial sacral movement, then the eustachian tubes can't stay open. And I started treating. The kid came in Tuesday, I saw it, and it's been over a year without an ear infection. Now, that obviously was one that had a lot of host component.
Dr. Stiles.
Yeah.
The host component. Do you, so let me give you an example. I saw a patient with, in the hospital a month ago, with right lower lobe pneumonia.
Yep.
I went to evaluate the first rib and the scalenes and the thoracic inlet and outlet. And I put my hands there and I had the patient take a breath in, and the left, I could feel the left pulmonary lung just blow right up, and the right lung was really slow and delayed in moving.
Yep.
My assessment of the situation was, well, I think the right lower lobe pneumonia has caused this, what I felt as a rib restriction.
No, but see, the question, see, whenever I walk into a room like that with a patient, my question is, why are they having this now? Why didn't they have this a week ago, a month ago, 6 months ago? See, and when you go in with that perspective and say to the patient, hey, I'm going to be examining you, and has there been any problems with the musculoskeleton recently, any injuries, car accidents, falls, whiplash injuries, you name it, and have the patient say, yeah, about 2 months ago, I was a little in a little fender bender, and my head got whipped around, and my neck was stiff for a few days, but then it quieted down, and I had some upper back pain for a couple of days, but then it quieted down, and then 3 months later, they developed the pneumonia. Well, I think that somatic dysfunction may have predisposed the patient, because if that right rib is caught in exhalation, that can lock up that whole side as a group pattern in exhalation. And if it is, then those lower ribs can't work right. The diaphragm can't work right. And is that why they weren't getting good venous and lymphatic drainage out of that area? And that's why the, because why isn't the pneumonia bilaterally? Because all the dysfunction's on the right side. Is that coincidental?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember in med school what the explanation was for right lower lobe pneumonia more than left. There was a...
Well, it's lower in the drainage. The angle of drainage is different, a little different. It's more vertical.
So it's more difficult to...
To get drainage out of it.
Yeah. Excursion of fluid.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. Okay. So really, that's interesting. That is really interesting to me. So you don't think... So essentially, you're telling me, and that's totally fine because I'm here to learn, that maybe it wasn't the pneumonia that was causing the rib restriction on the right side, but rather a somatic dysfunction that this person had before they had pneumonia on that right side that predisposed them to the pneumonia.
Exactly.
And that's, we need to find that. I guess I could use your term, the key lesion or the key rib.
Yeah.
Key vertebra.
But then that upper rib cage and thoracic inlet may have been locked up because they had a 10th rib on the other side that was caught in inspiration. And if that's the case, what's the key rib for releasing that? The bottom rib of the group, right? So right. Then if the 10th rib isn't functioning right, that can lock up the first rib like everything, and you can treat the thoracic inlet till the cows come home, and it's not going to release because it's secondary to the 10th rib. or it may be secondary to something in the upper extremity that's affecting the musculature to the rib cage and playing a role in it.
Yeah.
So there's the difference between what Mitchell called allopathic osteopathy and osteopathy. See, so because I look at the patient, I'm saying to the patient, well, I see him with pneumonia. What you're going to hope is that when I examine you, I can find somatic dysfunction. And you're going to hope that it's playing an etiological role in your problem. And you're going to want to hope that effective OMT can change it. And if those three things answers are yes, then I may be able to help you. And I've seen one of the early ones in Pikeville was a patient with pneumonia, had been in the hospital for 5 days and on medications, all the consults and everything, and wasn't getting any better. And someone wrote a consult for me, and I treated and found all sorts of thoracic, rib cage, cranial stuff, sir, because that's the primary respiratory mechanism. And if that's locked up, that's going to affect the secondary mechanism. I got through, the guy jumped out of bed and was walking around the room, said, I was wonderful. Here he'd been in there 5 days and not improving at all. They discharged him that afternoon.
Wow, it's incredible.
But see, so I want to look at the whole patient, because the body is a non, tensegrity says the musculoskeletal system is a very non-linear system. And we tend to think of osteopathy very linearly. And I think that's a big mistake.
Yeah, I think you're spot on there. I would agree that the human, the persona, the tensegrity model, the fascia.
Oh, yeah.
That in and of itself is I would say, nonlinear.
Yep.
But then you have the complexity of the psychosomatic and
yep.
the nervous system. And so it's quite complex.
See, and that's why... there's the difference right there between, say, an MD and a DO that does OMT, because they'd say, oh, pneumonia, it's this bug, this prescription, this antibiotic. But see, I'd want you to walk in the room and say, what lowered the patient's resistance? What increased their susceptibility? Start getting that from the history. You find out some old injuries. And then you say, okay, then this may have predisposed you, and your body's been compensating and compensating and compensating. But then all of a sudden, it couldn't compensate anymore. And that's why now you've got the pneumonia.
So in your mind, Dr. Stiles, if somatic dysfunction truly predisposes us to illness or disease, a disease process, shouldn't then all people get prophylactic OMT?
Oh, I think you are absolutely right. See, that's why I always say, and it gets a lot of people upset. See, I think if you wanted to bring health, if they made me czar of medicine and said, we want to bring down healthcare costs, I'd say the gatekeepers to all physicians would be DOGPs that do OMT. See, because if they screened out a lot of that stuff, and I found when I was doing general practice in my first few years of practice, a patient would come in and I'd say, look, you're not really acute. You're not going to die from this and this and this and this. And they say you got this, this, and this. Let me examine you and see if I find some dysfunction, because I believe you got the disease they're talking about. But let me see if there's some dysfunction. Oh, I found this, and this could affect circulation, and this could affect the sympathetics, and this could affect the parasympathetics, and this could affect rib cage mechanics and ventilation and venous lymphatic circulation. So you're not acute. Let me treat you, and then let me see you again in a couple of days. And let's see how you're doing. And what I found was I wrote far less medicine than my colleagues.
With like better or equal outcomes?
No, far less, because with good outcomes, because I was getting to the what predisposed them to it. And once that started to change and I found it, fixed it, lived it alone, and their health potential started to emerge, then they needed less medication, or if they did, they used lower dosages for shorter periods of time and things. And people loved it because they were saying, man, every time I go out, they give me 3 or 4 different medications. Sometimes you don't give me any, or in a couple of days, you may give me some.
So if I was to play devil's advocate, yep. Dr. Stiles, And I asked you, how do you know that the somatic dysfunction is predisposing this person to, let's say, pneumonia? That's kind of what we've been talking about a little bit.
Okay.
How is this? Would you say it's anecdotal? It's subjective? Or do we have any, I don't know, any data that you're aware of?
Well, we had a lot of data in Waterville, and all that stuff is archived now, and I wish we could get to it. Because we did that pulmonary function testing was just coming on the market in those days. And after I sequenced people out and treated them so they could be pneumonia patients, asthmatics, COPDers and everything, most of the time there was a dramatic improvement in their pulmonary function tests, both the obstructive phase and the restrictive phase. Well, that says to me then that somatic dysfunction was probably a predisposing factor. Because if I treat that and it doesn't have any impact on their clinical condition, then I'd say the somatic dysfunction is coincidental.
And you think that somatic dysfunction was there before they had the asthma PD?
Oh, yeah. I think it predisposed them to it.
You don't think that it was a result of the asthma, the COPD?
No, because like you say with pneumonia patients, if you say to most medical docs, why do they have pneumonia now? They got exposed to some bugs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. See, and we had a guy that was a linguistics guy at Pikeville when I first got there and read all the Stills stuff and everything. And it was amazing because one of the questions he brought up that one, why was Still the MD that came up with osteopathy? Why didn't some other MD do that? And the conclusion he came to was Still had a wife and three kids die of meningitis. Now, the traditional MD at that time, because there were no antibiotics, would say, we got to need better sterilization. We need better septic techniques and things like that. But what he thought Still said was, wait a minute. Why didn't the rest of us that were in the family and exposed to those same bugs, why didn't we die? And that sent him down the path to osteopathy.
That's interesting. That's, I want to say, revolutionary way to think and approach the patient and the health of the patient. But you're changing my thought process.
But then it's fun because you see and think about it. There's a lot of OMT protocols and models and stuff. And some of the quotes I love was the guy Cannon, the big guy that came up with homeostasis.
Mm-hmm.
One of his famous quotes was, systems do not exist in nature. They only exist in the minds of humans. See, the body is an integrated functional unit, and we tend to divide it up so we can teach it easier, and we practice that way, but that's not the way the body functions. And I think the same thing models can represent stuff, but it's not an accurate representation lots of times. So I have trouble with the five osteopathic models. And what's the big thing right now in medicine? Patient-specific care. Well, what we're talking about, I think, could be described as patient-specific OMT. So when I walk in that room, I'm asking myself, what lowered their resistance? What increases the screen them out? And once I find the dysfunctions and say, okay, this could affect the circulation and this could affect this and this could affect, then I've got maybe five factors that could be predisposing them to it. See, then I can come up with a pathophysiological hypothesis of what's going on with that patient that most doctors could never come up with. Because it's all theory, whereas mine hypothesis is all based on clinical findings and observing the response when I treat it. Because if the patient's an asthmatic and wheezing like everything, and I find, hey, I screen them out and sequence them and find, hey, the area greatest restriction is cranial, and it's at the occipital petrous suture, and that's the jugular foramen, and that could be stimulating the vagus, and that could be causing the bronchial constriction, and I treat it, and the wheezing stops like that, I think I can assume that was probably, and that's why the sympathetomimetic drugs weren't working, because it wasn't a hypoactive sympathetic system, it was a hyperactive parasympathetic system.
Hmm.
You know how if you take your findings, you can work it backwards and you can come up with a beautiful and a pathophysiological hypothesis. And I maintain if you do that, you'll practice medicine differently.
Yeah. I mean, you're already kind of revolutionizing how I'm.
This is all based on my mentors. I got most of this from Fred Mitchell Sr. and then from the 5 years in Waterville, because when we were seeing all sorts of clinical conditions respond beautifully to OMT, we were thinking, why the hell weren't we taught this in school? Why are we learning this in a little 80-bed hospital up in Waterville, Maine? Because we're trying to combine host disease care and see if that won't help the patients realize their health potential.
Yeah. Jordan, I've got another question.
No, keep going. I just love listening.
Dr. Stiles, I want to tap into your experience, your clinical experience. I appreciate how you said that people are an integrated whole.
Yep.
And we need to look at them that way. What other clinical examples do you have in your experience where this particular patient had a particular illness, you treated the somatic dysfunction that you thought was at the root that predisposed them to the illness, and they got better?
The one that comes to mind was, this was another early one in Pikeville. And it was a woman that had acute pancreatitis and right lower lobe pneumonia. And she'd been in the hospital for 6 or 7 days, wasn't responding well. And someone wrote a consult, and we walk in the room at 7 o'clock in the morning. The room is dark. We turn on the light. She's in a fetal position with an IV running and a narcotic because of her pancreatic pain and stuff. And I explained what I was doing and where I was coming from. And she said, yeah, I don't have any problem with that. Because I said, you're getting good medical care. Why isn't your body responding? And the somatic dysfunction may be predisposing you so that you can't respond the way you should to the medications. So I said, I need to have you lie on your back so I can screen you out in bed. And she said, well, it hurts when I lie on my back. And I said, well, it'll just be a short period of time. And you would think, because what pancreatitis, if they extend, they have a lot of pain because the pancreas is retroperitoneal. So then everybody was thinking that's why she doesn't lay on her back. So I found the first thing I found was an occipital petrous suture thing, treated that. And as soon as that released, she said, I can take a better breath. Well, I said, okay, then that was probably affecting the vagus and causing some bronchial constriction. Then I rescreened and found some upper thoracic stuff and said, whoa, this could be affecting the sympathetic to the lungs and the sympathetic vasomotor supply. And if that's hindering that, you may have a good blood level of antibiotic, but maybe it's not getting to the lung, and that's why the pneumonia isn't responding. And I treated that, and she said, ooh. And what I found was a flex dysfunction about T7, which should be the innervations to the pancreas. And as soon as I treated that functionally with her in bed, she said, I can lie on my back now. The pain is gone. See, so it wasn't because of the pancreas pain, the pain. It was because she had a flex dysfunction and it couldn't go into extension. Then I found some lower right rib dysfunction. And I treated that functionally. And she said, now I can really take a deep breath. And here, remember, I said we walked in the room and she's in a fetal position in the dark. She jumped out of bed and is walking around the room with an IV pole saying, I feel so much better. Well, the doc that wrote the consult said, come on down, because all the interns and residents and a bunch of students, they were, you know, we'll go up and watch Stiles be made a fool of treating this patient that's been in the hospital for several days. And so they said, come on down and explain to you what you think the findings were and how you think it correlated. So I did, and we spent maybe 20 minutes doing that. And the chairman of the family medicine said, hey, I think I'm going to go back. She was so much different walking around the room. She's NPO because of the pancreatitis. I think I'll go up and put her on a liquid diet. He came back down. He says, I don't believe this. The woman was walking around in the room. She said, I just had the best bowel movement I've had in 3 weeks. I feel great. I want to go home. She was discharged that afternoon.
So she had clinical findings of pancreatitis.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But the somatic dysfunction, because if the parasympathetic's cranked up, what's that doing to the pancreas? And then if she had somatic dysfunction at this, like around T7, that could either stimulate or inhibit the sympathetic. Well, I wonder if that inhibited the sympathetic and she's got a cranked up parasympathetic, what's that going to do to the pancreas?
I think the pancreas would be as active. Yeah. Huh. That quick.
Yeah.
Turnaround.
Now, if the somatic dysfunction hadn't been playing a role, that wouldn't have happened. But see, what most doctors hate to see patients with thick charts. And I found this when I practiced in Boston. The thicker the chart, the happier I am. Because usually what it means, especially when I was practicing in Boston, across the street from Harvard, that everything known to man had been done to them except examine their musculoskeletal system. And if I found somatic dysfunction, man, I was going to get some great results and I was going to have some real fun.
Wow. So this patient had pancreatitis and you thought, your first thought is, I'm going to go to the head and check out her cranium because the vagus nerve may be hypo or hyperactive.
Hyperactive. So stimulated. That would cause bronchial contraction. It would increase peristalsis in the GI tract. It could crank up the pancreas. And then if she had mid-thoracic stuff, that would be the sympathetic innervation to the GI tract and the pulmonary system. And if that was inhibited, then maybe she wasn't getting good circulation into the tissue. Maybe the medications weren't getting there. But if the sympathetic was inhibited and the parasympathetic is way out of balance now, then could that really crank up that pancreas? See, well, you would never come up with that medically because it would all be theory. But it was all based on what I found. And when I got a response and the patient says, "Woo, I feel better. I took a better breath of air. My pain is decreased." This is, well, then that says to me, then that somatic dysfunction was playing an etiological role. And as soon as I addressed it, I saw a positive homeostatic response.
Do you have other examples, Dr. Stiles, that you could share with us?
Yeah, because now I don't do any hospital stuff now. They haven't been letting me do any hospital stuff since COVID. Mm-hmm. And so I'd have to, I was treating the MI patients in the intensive care unit. The internists had me treating them. And a year after I started that hospital program in Waterville, the director of Medicare called me and said, "What the heck is somatic dysfunction?" Because we had that diagnosis code, but we didn't have any therapeutic codes or code numbers. And I said, I explained to him and I said, "Why?" And he said, "Don't you realize you're saving us a lot of money?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, there's a bunch of small hospitals around Waterville and patients go into those hospitals with chest pain. Their EKGs are normal. Their enzymes are normal because that's all you had in 73. You didn't have all the imaging and everything. And they're in the unit for about 5 days. They're discharged with a diagnosis, chest pain, etiology unknown, Tietze syndrome, costochondritis and everything. Then some of those patients ended up in Waterville Osteopathic Hospital. You did a consult. In the consult, they said somatic dysfunction, and that hospital patient was immediately discharged, or they got out a lot quicker. They weren't readmitted. They needed less medication. And that's how I got the 5-level coding system. It was all based on my data in the Medicare computers.
Yeah, that's great. That's wonderful that you did that for our profession. But any other clinical examples, Dr. Stiles, where they had somatic dysfunction that you believe predisposed them to a disease process? You treated the somatic dysfunction and the patient improved.
Oh, and see, I expect it. And I'll give you an example. Had someone got to try to do it so nobody could identify. But it was a patient that was grossly overweight, was like in the mid to late 40s, had disc degeneration at about every level in the lumbar spine, stenosis all over the place in the lumbar spine, facet degenerative osteoarthritic changes, had been worked up at UK. And we at UK, they have one of the top neurosurgeons in the country. His name just got just vanished from me. Gibbs. And he said he had found out about me years ago when we started about Pikeville. And he said, you're from the Pikeville area? Yeah. He said, go see Styles. Because he said, your back is such a mess. I don't want to operate on that back unless I absolutely have to. And I'd want to do everything conservatively. Go see what you can do. And I treated the guy three times with functional techniques. And I can check, you know, the records of patients. He hasn't seen an orthopod or a neurologist or anybody else since I did those three treatments. And the last time I saw him, he said, I'm pain free. Well, you wouldn't expect that.
You wouldn't expect that if it wasn't somatic dysfunction.
Yeah. I mean, with all those disc changes and everything and stenosis and everything. So think about it. What would have happened to him if he had surgery? Would that have been another complicating factor? See, and I think the neurosurgeon was smart saying, I don't want to operate on that back. Right. I'm not ready to go in there now. Let's do everything conservatively.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, those are incredible success stories. Have you had cases where you thought it may have been somatic dysfunction, you treated the somatic dysfunction, and they didn't get better?
Oh, sure.
And if so, why do you think that is?
Because the somatic dysfunction wasn't playing an etiological role.
Got it. Can you give us an example of that?
Yeah. Another guy that I saw yesterday, his back is basically the same as the other person. He was referred to me by neurosurgery. And his main complaint is just bilateral numbness and tingling in both legs. And it's not dermatomal. It's widespread in both legs. And the surgeon didn't want to operate on him yet. And they referred him to me. And he's seeing some gradual improvement. I've been treating him for several months now. But he's seeing some improvement. And again, you wouldn't expect that you'd be able to help somebody like that with OMT.
But what about cases where...
But then I've had other people that were like that and they had somatic dysfunction. You treated them and it didn't have any impact at all, any beneficial impact at all. So that says to me then the somatic dysfunction was just coincidental and it wasn't playing an etiological role.
So... To figure out if the somatic dysfunction is playing the etiological role or is the cause or the is predisposing to the disease process,
yep.
The only way to really know is if you treat it.
Yeah.
Is that
yeah, exactly.
So it's kind of, I mean, manual manipulation, OMT is trial and error.
Well, in a way, I wouldn't want to say trial and error. I prefer to say testing a hypothesis.
Testing a hypothesis. Okay.
I'm saying, okay, I found this, and this, and this could exactly explain what's going on in you. Now, what you're going to hope is that mechanical dysfunction is playing a role. And if it is, my OMT is going to help. If it doesn't help, then at least we've ruled out a simple etiological role that may be playing a big player. Well, role in your picture.
But what I also find, Dr. Stiles, is that let's say the somatic dysfunction is playing an etiological role. There seems to be an if I use the correct modality of OMT treatment. I don't know why it is, but there are some people that respond well to muscle energy technique. There are other people that respond well to counter strain. There are other people that respond well to dry needling or HVLA.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for me to kind of decipher what this patient and this person in front of me needs as far as the modality to choose to treat the somatic dysfunction.
Well, see, I think Mitchell and Kimberly had the answer to that, I think. So if I find a somatic dysfunction and it's really acute, I'm always going to use an indirect technique. If the somatic dysfunction I find has some localized edema, I'm always going to use muscle energy, because as they contract and relax the muscles, it's going to pump the edema out of the tissues. If it's more, feels like it's more muscular tissue that are maintaining that, I'm going to use muscle energy, because then I can use the muscles to reestablish normal mechanics, and that'll usually balance up the muscle tone. If it feels old, chronic, fibrotic, I'm going to use high velocity. And if it's been fused either naturally or surgically, I'm always going to use functional techniques above and below to help them compensate so they don't develop a second disc problem.
What are your thoughts on treating the fascial system with the fascial distortion model?
I don't like the fascial distortion model. And the reason is because a lot of people really complain about pain. And I realize you don't have to do that, but I don't think you have. My experience is you don't have to hurt people to get them better. Hmm. Now, I think if you look at tensegrity, I think a lot of the myofascial is secondary to the joint mechanical dysfunction. And that once you get the mechanical dysfunction right, I think a lot of times the fascias pretty much take care of themselves.
You think it follows?
Yep.
Yeah, I've heard both. You know, I've heard people like, you can't treat the joint without treating the fascia. I've heard people say, treat the fascia and the joint mechanics will follow.
Well, the first functional course. Oh, with the functional course, I suggest you call it functional release techniques rather than you use. I thought the way you described it, some people could think it was facilitated positional release.
Oh, I see. Okay. Functional release rather than functional positional release. Got it.
Yep. So now I lost my train of thought. What were we?
So we were talking about how do you choose the OMT modality to treat a specific somatic dysfunction? How do you know which modality to choose?
Yeah, so that's why, like I described, by the feel of the restrictive barrier. I let those. So when I do my screen, I find out where I think the key area is, and people can think, oh, big deal. But I also know by the feel of the tissues what type of technique I'm going to use. Because one time at Michigan State, an MD said to me, what's your favorite technique? And it was like a volcano went off inside me. And I pointed at him. I said, don't you ever ask that question again. He said, what are you talking about? And I said, you just created a volcano in me. And I said, because I'm opposed to me having a favorite technique. To me, my favorite technique is what's appropriate for that specific somatic dysfunction. Is it acute? Is it more edema? Is it muscle? Is it more fibrotic? That's when I select my technique. And because then it's appropriate, I think, for the patient, not what I like to do or have fun doing. It's what does that patient need?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's for me, not always easy to decipher.
No. Sure. So then make a decision of what you think it is. Use the technique and see if it responds. If it does, you made the right choice. If it doesn't, don't think of it as pass or fail. Just think, oh, wait a minute, I got to rethink this.
Mm-hmm. Jordan, do you have any follow-up questions? I'm sorry. I bombarded Dr. Stiles in my question.
Learning.
Man, I feel like we're just getting started.
I know we are.
To kind of like circle back to where we started this conversation with like, maintaining an osteopathic philosophy in Western medicine.
I think it's more than that, because I've had, because I've done a lot of lecturing all over the United States, Canada, and a lot in Europe and stuff. And I've had more people come up to me and say, you've studied Asian medicine, Oriental medicine. I said, no, I haven't. They said, yes, you have. No, I haven't. And I've had that over and over and over. And my last resident was an American Asian. And she was neat because she was really into Oriental medicine. And what we realized was they're both host orientated. So I think osteopathic care then can affect Asian medicine. It can affect, and I had a guy, the first functional course I taught at Michigan State. This was in 79. I mean, 89. And there was a guy in the course that was a big name acupuncturist from Oregon. And you didn't have all the texting and everything and email you have now, but he called me a couple of weeks later and he said, hey, I want to thank you. That was a fun course. I learned a lot, but you've improved my acupuncture results. And I said, what are you talking about? I don't know anything about acupuncture. And he said, well, I know where the meridians are and know where the points are to needle them. But after your course, functional course, my palpatory skills improved like everything. And now what I do is palpate down the meridians, and wherever there's a hard spot or a soft spot, I needle it. My results have improved like everything.
Hmm. Wow. So question or a request for advice.
Yeah.
What would you say to a med student or a resident or a new doc out in practice who's had all of this osteopathic training, understands the philosophies and the perspectives and is competent in doing OMM, but feels pressured?
Feel pressured what?
he just cut out. So, he'll hopefully sign back on.
Okay.
While Jordan is signing back on,
we got some somatic dysfunction in here.
He's got some somatic dysfunction in his.
We got a hindrance.
Yes, we do. We have a hindrance, obstructing our connection. So, I really appreciate this.
I'm back. Okay. Can you?
Oh, he's back. He's back. Okay. Jordan, finish.
I'm sorry. My phone cut out. Okay. So feels pressured by, a medical system, like to provide a standard of care, like an allopathic standard of care.
Yep.
And doesn't have the time to evaluate and treat osteopathically.
Yeah. And boy, that drive me crazy. Cause see, I started out doing general practice. And after 2.5 years, one night I said to my wife, you know, I got a problem because I've got a bunch of patients that are benefiting from OMT, but I'm booked out and I can't get them in because I'm spending a lot of time writing scripts for a bunch of people that other people in town could be writing those scripts. I need to start limiting my practice. And I just backed off more and more of general practice and eventually got into where I had just strictly a manipulative practice. And I did it on a cash basis, which was really nice because then only the people come to you that want to help because they're paying their own money. If the insurance company will pay for the OMT, they'll come forever, whether you're helping them or not. But boy, if it's their money, it's amazing how if you're not helping them, they don't return. But if they do, it's amazing how sometimes you realize that they're really strapped financially and where are they finding the money to come, but they say it's worth it.
Hmm.
Yeah, see that. Did you have anything else, Jordan, you wanted to ask Dr. Stiles?
Yeah, there was a lot of questions that have come up along the way. I guess, do you have an explanation or insight into, like, what if I have a patient and just cannot find a somatic dysfunction that could be causing or contributing to their condition versus a patient who has horrible mechanics, like awful scoliosis, all of this other stuff, and they feel wonderful. How do you walk that line?
Yeah, I marvel at how amazing the body can adapt to all sorts of adverse situations. I mean, it's amazing. And we had an old time doc at Kirksville when I was there that was amazing. And he said, and it, to me, that answered your question away. He said, you know, it's unfortunate that doctors find out so early in their careers that many times patients get better in spite of what doctors do to them. and that some people you can't understand how they could be asymptomatic when you would think, because you have other patients that have 1/10 the somatic dysfunction they're having, and they're in all sorts of pain. So you can't predict whether it's playing a big role or not until you treat the patient.
That is a good point,
Dr. Stiles. Unless Jordan, you had a burning question, because I asked a lot of questions.
Oh, I got my two burning questions out.
So. Well, I've got some more burning questions. Dr. Stiles, so if we could transition a little bit into the key lesion.
Yep.
We've already gone an hour, but yes, you're right. I feel like we're just getting the wheels rolling.
Yep.
Key lesion. So how did you come up with this, or how did you discover this idea of treating the key lesion of the body?
Okay. Still talked about finding the key lesion. McConnell, who was what many people thought he was the clone to Still, he wrote a lot of stuff about the key lesion. So in the early days, a lot of people were looking for that key lesion. Now, how I got into it was in the first muscle energy tutorial with Fred Mitchell Sr., because he made references to it, but he spent most of that 5-day tutorial teaching us his techniques. And I picked up that he did a screen, and he never seemed to start where their chief complaint was, and he treated all sorts, many times never treated their area chief complaint, yet all the symptoms of that area cleared up. And I found it fascinating, because Laughlin screened for the key lesion. Wilson, when I took his practice over, he screened, but none of those guys could really explain how you found that and what you did. They just knew how to do it. Okay. So then about 3 years after the tutorial, I was visiting Mitchell Sr. in Chattanooga. And he said, he had a home office combination. He said, hey, during this trip, I want you to treat some of my patients, and I'll just sit in the corner and watch. And I said, sure. And I was young and arrogant. I thought, man, I'll show the old man I can really do his stuff, that I'm really competent. So the first woman was a low back pain and sciatica. And he did a screen, and Laughlin couldn't describe functionally. He would just say, take the doodad where it wants to go and fiddle and diddle. So I had to mimic what I thought he was doing. And eventually I got the language and the concepts to be able to put it together and describe it. But it took me 28 years to do that. So I mimicked the screen that Mitchell was doing. And I found some cervical stuff and thoracic and some rib stuff and some lumbar and some sacral stuff and innominate. And I thought I had just done a fabulous job. And I got all through, and Mitchell's just sitting in the corner watching me and watching my screen. And he said to the woman, stand up and face me. And he said, how do you feel now compared to when you came in? And she said, I don't feel one bit different. Well, man, my mouth flew open. And we had developed a good relationship by then. And I turned to him, because I did all muscle energy, so much for your stuff. And he said, what he would have said to me in today's language is, you're very competent in doing my techniques, but you are totally incompetent in how I problem solve osteopathically. And he's from my screen, he said, I want you to retreat her. You can't add a technique or subtract a technique, but do it in this order. Now retreat her in that order. And he got that from my screen, watching me screen. And I retreated her, and he got through, and he said, stand up and face me. And she did. And he said, how do you feel now? And she pointed at him, and she said, now I feel like I do after you treat me. And I thought, oh my God, it's not his techniques to get the results. It's how he problem solves. And I think he had the same reaction. Like, oh my God, a lot of people have learned my techniques, but they're not going to get the results I get, because I forgot to tell them how I sequence it, and how I didn't realize up until now how important that is in my outcomes. So then the second one was another one, low back pain. And again, I was a little more humble treating her, the second patient. And I did the screen that I thought he was doing, and I treated a bunch of areas, and I got all through. And Mitchell said, stand up, walk around the table, and lie back down. And like I said, I'd found some rib dysfunction, thoracic stuff, some sacral stuff, NAMA, some lumbar stuff. And I rechecked her, and everything I had treated was back. And I said, it was like nothing had been done. And I said to him, how could that be? And he said, because her key was in her legs and you ignored that. And as soon as she stood up and walked three steps going around the table, she walked right back into her. Now, retreat her, don't add a technique, but do it in this order. He told me the order I did. Then he said to her, stand up, jump on one leg, jump on the other leg. And I'm thinking, God, just three steps put her back in the air. He said, jump on both legs, lie down, recheck her, and everything stayed corrected. And I realized I got to try to figure out what the hell he's doing, how he's doing this. And his son, Fred Jr., who's in Lansing, has admitted to me he never could figure out his father's thought process. But he's heard me lecture on it. He said, I think you may be getting it.
So
I didn't develop it. He's the one that spurred it. I just tried to organize it and make it teachable.
Okay. Can you give us, probably won't do it justice, but a clinical, a case scenario?
Yeah.
Of a patient and
The one that always comes to mind was with my last resident. And she came and got me and she said, hey, I just screened this guy out. And he's an old coal miner and he's had a lot of rib cage trauma and thoracic trauma. And boy, when I screen him, it feels like his whole thoracic area and rib cage is just welded together. And so whenever I precept, I like to be able to confirm what they're palpating. So I screened and I'm standing up and I said, man, you're right. This feels like it's been welded. I've never felt a rib cage and thoracic area this locked up. So then I said to him, sit down for me. And I said, did you check him sitting? She said, no. I said, sit down. When he sat down and I rescreened him, his back was totally different. It was a lot more flexible. And I said, so Mitchell would say then, the problem's in the legs. Because when he sat down, it removed the influence of the legs and that whole back was functioning a lot better. So I screened out his left shoulder, he could only abduct to about 80 degrees. And he could bring it forward only about 45 degrees, adducting. And I screened out the lower extremity and said, hey, you've got a distal fibula dysfunction on the other side. And he said, oh, I forgot to tell you. I broke that ankle 20 years ago, and there's still some hardware in there. And I thought, okay, then I'm going to treat this functionally because I don't want to put a bunch of force in there. But let's see if I could help him adapt. So I treated it functionally and I got a nice release. And I said, okay, I want to do just that one thing. Now stand up and check your range of motion. He had full range of motion of the shoulder.
After treating the fibula?
Yes, distal fibula.
Distal fibula. So how would you explain that from, let's say, a tensegrity model?
Well, you can't, but it's just, but these tensegrity systems, they try to protect the weakest link in the system. And I think the weakest link in the system is the most dysfunctional area. And his most dysfunctional area was that left distal fibula. So his whole tensegrity system was trying to adapt. And where they get the pain is where they can't adapt. And so it looked like he couldn't adapt in his shoulder and rib cage.
Interesting.
Now, think about if he had been, I was thinking about him when the other day when the guy was talking to you about shoulder problems and ultrasound and everything, you know, because, you know, they were saying, well, maybe we ought to look at the elbow and maybe we need to look at the neck and maybe, well, you'd never seen a protocol in shoulder problems. Check the distal fibula.
They would laugh at us.
Oh yeah.
They'd be like, you guys are nuts.
But I had the results to prove it.
Yeah.
So I was, that was my hypothesis. That was his key. So then I said, okay. And it looks like I want to do a functional technique. So it's, I found the key. I matched the technique to the barrier dysfunction, treated it, and it responded. Then that says to me, my hypothesis was right.
Yeah. I mean, you can't argue with results.
And what do you think would have happened if I had done all sorts of techniques on his shoulder and hadn't treated the distal fibula? You wouldn't, yes, you would have just fought you and resisted you. And...
So let's say you didn't treat the distal fibula and you treated his shoulder with the Spencer technique and you mobilized the scapula. You treated the AC joint and the first rib and the upper rib cage. And he comes back a week or 2 weeks later and it's the exact same.
Then I'd say my hypothesis was wrong. I got to rescreen him. I missed. If your somatic dysfunction is playing a role, I missed the key lesion. I got to rescreen him.
How much, though, of the somatic dysfunction is in, let's say, lifestyle? Let's say he's a coal miner and he's shoveling coal with a shovel, throwing the coal over his left shoulder all day for 6 hours.
Yep. But then what I find many times is when you treat the key area, they'll say, you know, I haven't been able to do that for years without pain, but I can do it now without pain.
Hmm. Okay. Hmm. So you don't think that lifestyle modifications is as important as treating the key lesion?
Oh, yeah, because the research that I've – sometime we ought to talk about the research I've been doing in Eugene, Oregon. And we put people on a sophisticated treadmill and hook them up to surface EMGs and get their pictural pattern, their attractor pattern of complex science attractor pattern. Then I take them into a room and sequence them out and put them back on the treadmill. And 80% of the time, the first time I treated them, we saw dramatic changes and hypotonic muscles automatically toned up, hypertonic ones automatically relaxed. I didn't have to stretch out muscles. They just started firing normally. 80% of the time, the first time I treated them.
So treating the somatic dysfunction altered the neurology,
yep,
essentially.
Yep. And I would maintain if you don't do that and you try to get them to do an exercise program. And so Phil Greenman and I used to argue about this all the time with the exercise prescription, because we see motor pattern changes in a lot of the shoulder patterns and low back patterns, firing patterns automatically normalize after you sequence them out. And I would maintain if you don't treat them first and have them do an exercise program, you may be adding another stressor. Because the body may be saying, hey, I'm trying to adapt to this, and this down here, and you're trying to make me do something I can't even do. You're just making it harder for me. And it makes sense linear thinking. Yep, I need to do this, but the body hasn't read the book.
What about core stability?
I've seen that automatically change and improve.
Do you think that plays a role in pelvic dysfunction, SI joint dysfunction, sacral dysfunction, the classic?
Yeah, and I think it can go either way.
What do you mean?
I think the core changes may be secondary to the pelvis. And as soon as you treat out the pelvis and the rib cage and you get the abdominals functioning properly and quadratus lumbar and firing properly and the leg muscles firing properly, then lots of times the core tone immediately tones up.
So you think it can go either way? It could, yep, be core stability leading to sacral, pelvic, and innominate pubic symphysis dysfunction, or it could also be dysfunction in the pelvis, the sacrum, leading to inhibition of the deep trunk stabilizers.
Yep.
What are your thoughts on sending patients to PT? Do you feel like PT and OMT work hand in hand together?
Well, that's interesting because over the years, when they first started the postgraduate stuff at Michigan State, the people that were coming were MDs, DOs, PTs, dentists. And I was really fighting it. And our Greenman and I argued about this. And I said, Phil, man, we're giving our profession away. And he said, no, wait a minute. They're licensed to practice musculoskeletal medicine. We're not teaching them how to become osteopathic physicians. We're just teaching them how to manipulate the musculoskeletal system. And I thought, okay, I guess I could buy that and start doing that. Well, so then a lot of PTs had me teaching. Now, I've taught thousands of PTs. And most of them tell me that once they learn sequencing and learn the osteopathic stuff, they had to do far less exercise stuff. So I don't like to refer a patient to a PT unless they know what I'm doing, because they can do things that body isn't ready to do.
Yeah, I could see that. I have found a really good PT in town that I've rotated with, and I really have greatly appreciated his knowledge of anatomy. And he has taken a number of our CME courses at Michigan State. So he has a good idea and understanding of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And has training in it. And I send a lot of patients to him, and I haven't had one single patient come back to me and not feel better. And it seems to me that I hope that I am helping them with their muscle firing by getting rid of somatic dysfunction and then sending them to this PT to help with strengthening. And I think it also helps them be accountable because they go twice a week.
Yeah, but see, what we're finding in Eugene was a lot of those people, once I started treating them, and that they needed far less PT. And so that I think I want to, first of all, make sure that they're as mechanically functional as possible, because if they're not, and they do some of the traditional PT stuff, trying to tone up muscles and things like that, they're just putting another stressor into the system.
Because I treated this one lady, Dr. Stiles. She had what I diagnosed as mechanical low back pain, non-radicular symptoms, found sacral dysfunction, lumbar dysfunction, pubic symphysis, and innominate dysfunction. I treated it for like a year. I wouldn't say it was getting a whole lot better. She'd be good for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks. I sent her to PT. She's like, Dr. Green, I'm 90% better.
Yep.
So was I missing the key lesion?
I thought that would be my guess, because see, and I went back 5 years and looked at patients I had treated 5 years earlier. And I didn't understand my practice, because it was all handwritten notes. And I always wrote down the order I treated people. And if I put down T5 ERS left and left it that way, I know I use muscle energy. If I put a T after it, I know I use the thrusting force. If I put an F after it, I know I used a functional indirect technique. So I knew the order I treated people and the technique that I used. And what blew me away was 60% of my acute low backs, with or without sciatica, the area greatest restriction was thoracic area and rib cage. And once that was treated, the low back just melted. So I would be suspicious with that patient that there was probably a bunch of thoracic and rib cage stuff going on. Or the same thing can happen if it's in the lower extremities.
How come just going to PT twice a week helped them with their back pain then, you think?
Well, I think you helped the patient compensate. And then the patient was able to get a little better muscle tone and maybe do better. But they still hadn't realized their health potential.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So if you get the key lesion, essentially the body unwinds, they function more optimally, they're less likely to get sick.
Yep.
If they come back to you 2 weeks later and like, hey, I had a week of relief and then things just came back as before, you probably missed the key lesion and you have to rescreen.
No, but how long has this been going on? Because if this has been a problem for 10 years, you're not going to change it with one or two treatments.
even if you get the key lesion.
Oh, yeah. Now, they'll get better and they'll get better. And lots of times what happens with those, they get better with two or three visits. Then they come back and say, man, I had a terrible reaction after that last treatment. Well, my first reaction was, what did I miss? What did I do wrong? And one day I got a little smarter and I said to the patient, let me ask you a question. Have you ever felt pain like this before? And they said, oh, yeah. 10 years ago, I was in a car accident. And the pain I have now is exactly like I had then. Well, I'd peel the layers off the onion. I'm back 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
See, and when I left, people, I had patients tell me, you took me through 3 motor vehicle accidents over a period of 30 years during your treating me.
That's a compliment. How much does posture play into this?
Well, I see. See, what I find is when you sequence people, most of the time their posture automatically improves.
Okay. So do you think that in a society where we have tech neck, right? Your head is not aligned with your shoulders and you are in sagittal plane imbalance and stressing your axial spine more.
Yep.
That plays into influencing somatic dysfunction, would you say?
Well, that could, but somatic dysfunction may be in there. And because of that, then they get in that position for long periods of time. Then the whole thing just flares up like everything. And one of the things Mitchell helped me a lot with, he said, a lot of people that you see are not an acute problem. They're an acute flare-up of a chronic problem.
Mm-hmm. I believe that.
Yep.
So
I see posture change automatically so many times. And they've said, I've done all the exercise, done this, didn't help at all. And I wish we had the time to tell you a story about it. Last time Greenman and I taught together, they had me treat a patient. And all the big names examined the patient and said there was her major problem was her glutes weren't firing. And she was a marathoner who hadn't been able to run for 3 or 4 months because of low back pain and headaches. And I sequenced her out after, and Greenman checked her, Ward checked her, Isaac tried to book out, checked her. Trying to think of who else was there. But most of those guys that were teaching in the postgraduate stuff. Well, after I found the key area and treated, then I had them all recheck her. And they said, wow, this firing pattern's better. This one's better. This one's better. Whoa. Then I did the second area. Ooh, this changed, this changed. When I got through, they said, wow, you've made a major change in all those firing patterns. And the glutes are beginning to kick in. And so she said, what do I do? And Phil said to her, boy, when glutes aren't firing, that you got a real problem. It's going to take a long, dedicated exercise program to rehabilitate that. But it's not going to be fun, but you're going to have to do it if you want to feel better. So she turned to me and said, what do you think? And I said, well, I just treated a bunch of stuff and the tissues responded beautifully. I would say, and we were teaching like from 6 a.m. to noon, and then we'd have a break until 5, and then we teach a couple hours, and then you could still go out to dinner. So I said, this was the last thing in that morning. And I said, during the break, I don't have any problem with you doing anything you would like to do or think about doing, with the provision that if you get a little pain, that's okay. If you get a little pain, and as you keep doing it, it gets worse, then stop. If you start doing something and you don't have pain and you start to get pain and it gets worse, then stop. If you get a little pain, but as you keep going, it gets better, then I have no problem. So with those provisions, do whatever you want during the 5-hour break. Well, she walked in at 5 o'clock and she looked like a totally different person. And I said, what in the hell's going on? And she said, and remember I was saying she's a marathoner and hadn't been able to run for 3 or 4 months. She said, during the break, I ran 15 miles, no headache, no back pain. Then I did 10, 20 meter sprints and I had the best times I've ever had. My glutes are kicking in.
Neurology can change that quick.
Oh, yes.
And would you say that it's very important for us to test muscle firing pre and post treatments?
Yes.
Do you do that on all your patients?
No, because I feel like I'm wasting my time. Because in Eugene, 80% of the people that I treated, like I treated some elite female runners. And what was amazing was their contact pressure at heel strike decreased on, these are like 110, 120 pound females. Their contact pressure at heel strike or foot strike running was decreased on an average between 7 and 10 pounds.
Really? Dr. Stiles,
and after I treat them, they said, we feel like we're running on air.
I'm waiting for this research to get published soon.
Yeah. I'll echo that. I want to read some of these articles and data.
That's really fascinating to me.
So I think we way underestimate how amazingly complex somatic dysfunction can be in the profound effects it can have. And if it's sequenced out treatly, see, then I think you're providing patient-specific care. And when you do that, the response of the nervous system can be profound. See, and Yanda and I, we always got in the same argument because he'd say, you know, well, all my exercise stuff and everything, the Greenman and Buchauer worked out is based on EMG studies. And I said, Vladimir, let me ask you a question. Were they all functional patients? Well, they were asymptomatic. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. I see a lot of patients that are asymptomatic, but they can have a ton of somatic dysfunction. So maybe it's possible you set up an exercise program on a bunch of faulty EMGs. Well, he went crazy. And Phil told me the last time we talked together, he tried to reproduce Yanda's EMG studies, and he couldn't do it.
Interesting. Interesting. Dr. Stiles, we could talk until midnight.
Which day?
We definitely need to have a follow-up session.
Okay, sure.
Fun. If you're open to,
because this stuff is so neat. And see, and I think we way underestimate what somatic dysfunction can do and how widespread the effects can be. And how, and I, the analogy I use, because patients will say to me, how in the world did that happen that quickly? I'm saying, here's the analogy I use, because Mitchell Sr. always used analogies, and that got me into it. I said, you walk in, you're limping, and I said, what's going on? I got a sore foot. Oh, let me check your foot. Oh, yeah, it's red, it's swollen, it's infected. Man, we got to put you on an antibiotic, and we better give you a muscle relaxant because there's a lot of muscle tightness there, and it's inflamed as everything. We better get anti-inflammatory in there, and we better give you something for pain. And let me see you again in 3 days. And they come back, and how are you doing? I'm not doing any better. Did you do everything I told you? Yep, I'm taking all the medications you told me. I'm doing everything you told me. Well, maybe sometimes it just takes some time. Let me see you again in a week. Come back. How are you doing? I'm no better. That day, I put my hand in the shoe and find out there's a nail in the shoe. It's amazing when you take the nail out. Things get better a lot very quickly.
Sure.
See, and to me, that's a perfect analogy of what we're doing with somatic dysfunction. And as long as that nail's in the shoe, you can treat all sorts of stuff and have them do postural exercises and core exercises and do all sorts of stuff. But if somatic dysfunction is inhibiting those muscles, man, you're whipping a tired horse in Kentucky terms.
Yeah, you're not winning the Kentucky Derby, that's for sure. Dr. Stiles, any closing remarks that you would like to make?
No, I've enjoyed this, and I enjoyed working with you guys last week. And I'm looking for the April thing of doing the functional techniques. And you said that all of you are going to be at convocation?
We will all be at convocation, yes. Yep. All the residents will.
So then we could spend some time then, and maybe in an evening or something, or if somebody, you know, if there isn't much going on, I'd be glad to spend some time with you guys and stuff and talk to you more about it.
That'd be great. You know, I love tapping into your wisdom and your knowledge and a life of experience treating people with with osteopathic manipulation.
Well, so this all came because I was fortunate enough to have three big name mentors early in my career. And this wasn't stuff I came up with. This is stuff that they taught me.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being willing to share it and being so generous with your time. And yes, look forward to seeing you at Convocation.
Very good.
Okay. Thanks so much, Dr. Stiles. Have a great evening.
Okay. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. Dr. Stiles has dedicated his life, career, and many late nights and early mornings to spread osteopathic medicine. We thank him for his dedication and for his example as a role model. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with one of the greats in the field of osteopathic medicine. If you would like to reach out to Dr. Stiles, you may at estiles@upike.edu. You can find his email in the show notes. If you have any questions, comments, or would like to be on the podcast, please email the onmmpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Be well, be curious, and spread osteopathy.